The following is a presentation of Morning Drive Media and the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. Welcome back to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network. I'm Ken Napzok. We are still here in Las Vegas for the Cauliflower Alley Club reunion, the 49th annual. Next year's the big 50th. We'll be back for that. Maybe we'll have cameras next time. But we've had a great time already this week. It's been fun. What I love about the CAC is you get the old, you get the new. And when I say old, I mean Dan Farron. Dan, you came in yesterday. We're recording this on Tuesday. We Sunday night had Kurt Brown and Fredo Esparza in this studio, and that was a crazy adventure, as one can imagine. That one was up, and that gave you a little taste of what was to come into CAC. But we're here for a California Classic Wrestling podcast on the road in Las Vegas at the Gold Coast Hotel and Casino for the CAC 49th, as we said. That's my phone, Dan. I'm the professional one, and my phone's going off.
Yeah, exactly.
It's phenomenal. Phil Lander. We got the old favorites. We're going to do an MPW retrospective, too, there. All right.
It'll be a long show.
Dan, welcome. Your return to CAC, right?
Yeah, I haven't been here for maybe at least 20 years. It's nice to be back again, and it reminds me why why I've missed it so much, because it's so wonderful. You walk through the casino, you see J.J. Dillon, you see Greg Valentine, you see Terry Funk playing Blackjack. Who would play against Blackjack against Terry Funk? That would be a scary situation, I think. But it's a lot of fun to be back, and it's also great to do something that I've wanted to do for so long, but oftentimes because of the fact the location isn't always works really well. We can do a roundtable today, taking some people from all across the country and putting together some really interesting material.
Yeah, and you are so excited for this episode. You're like a little giddy boy for this episode. So I'm going to let you take care of intros, proper intros, and I'm going to let you and Kurt, this is your show. I'm going to engineer here and listen and learn about the wrestling industry and the history here.
Why, thank you, sir. Just don't fall asleep. That's the only thing about it. No, I'm very excited about this. First of all, we mentioned him, Kurt Brown, Vandal Drummond, to my left. Say hello, Kurt.
Hello, good morning.
And he's back again. He has his coffee. He should be somewhat human at this point. And we have two guys. I'm very happy to have them here. One is a great historian who, if you've been following wrestling for a long time, you know the name of Tom Burt. Tom, thank you for being here today.
It's a pleasure, Dan, and thank you very much for having me on. I hope we can share some thoughts, maybe some humorous stories.
I'm sure we will.
As well as being in the company of a senior member of the community. It's a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
We have over 100 years of wrestling history here.
We do. We do that, exactly. It's weird. And we also have Frank Mott. Frank has worked with EWF and been around wrestling for a long time. Frank, thank you for being here today.
It's my pleasure to be here, and Dan, there was also mentioned about the time you've been around. Well, I want all of you to know that I spent time teaching Frank Gotch how to wrestle.
He's still got the stretch marks to prove.
You've been peeking.
Well, Frank, let's start with you. What drew you to professional wrestling, and when did you start going to wrestling matches?
Mr. Engineer, you've got about 4 hours.
Right? I got battery space. We can do this.
I grew up in the Mid-Atlantic area, and long before any of you, including the supposedly oldest one here, were looking at the earth here. I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia. My dad was a Navy officer, and my dad was a tremendous boxing fan and knew that there were only two things, the Navy, boxing, and the Brooklyn Dodgers. Well, the Dodgers have long gone. My dad took me to boxing matches, and I enjoyed them. I knew them and got enjoyed them a lot. But then somehow in school, I got involved in amateur wrestling and did reasonably well. I should mention that in school, I don't know if any of you all remember, but there was a wrestler named the Great Scott.
Yes.
Who used to come through the Carolinas and Virginia when he had some downtime. And he went to the Police Athletic League in Norfolk. And he taught some of us who were in high school a little bit more about grappling. And somehow he took a liking to my mat style and talked to me and said, you ought to go to the wrestling matches. And I conned my dad into taking me down to the old Norfolk Auditorium, which was long before the Scope and the WCW and all of that, that have kept Virginia a pretty much of a hotbed. So I went down there to the matches with him, and my dad, I think, wore handkerchiefs over his head so nobody would see him going to the wrestling show. And would, lo and behold, found out that 80% of the audience was sailors. Long story short, I met the promoter, Big Bill Lewis, who weighed about 380 pounds. He was even before Crockett. And he was a promoter par excellence, and he bought all the guys in from the Navy bases to come and watch the shows, and they were pretty rowdy, and he would always make sure he had Shore Patrol standing around, because when you have people like the Riot Squad, Ernie and Emil Dusik, the Becker brothers, George and Bobby, Hans Schnabel, and a number of others that you young kids won't remember, but I got involved in it, and by the age of 12, I was taking ring jackets around and dodging cups of coffee that were thrown at the guys. We had many, many interesting and fun experiences, some of them a little X-rated, so I don't want to embarrass anybody here. Needless to say, much to my dad's displeasure and disgust, I got really involved at a very young age, and even at the age of 14 and 15, I was wrestling on mats in Norfolk and Richmond, and I was called the newsboy at the time because I was so young. And my main job was, of course, getting the living daylights beat out of me by anybody that was touring the area. Eventually, some sense pounded into my head, and I started doing publicity and writing for a magazine such as Wrestling As You Like It, et cetera, which I know Tom Burke and Dan know real well, and The Ring Magazine and such. And it just went on to a life of degradation from there on. I have, much to my wife's displeasure, I've been involved in this business for approximately 100 years or so. But that's enough of a little intro.
Sure. How did you wind up in L.A.? Or the L.A. area here?
Well, again, I came from a service family, and as a kid and a young man, I lived in Norfolk and Key West and Pensacola, Montgomery, Alabama, San Francisco, any Navy place I wound up living in. Eventually, I spent the last 2 years of school in the Panama Canal Zone.
Wow.
And when I came back up here, all of our family went different ways, and my mom and the three kids, we went up to the two other kids. I can't even remember how many kids are in my family. They're all younger than me, that's all I know. Anyway, we would come out here for the summers. My mom would drive across country in the late 50s by herself with three kids, two dogs, and goldfish. And nowadays, you wouldn't think of doing something like that. Air conditioning used to be a pan of ice in the bottom of the car, and then we would take a rag and put it on her forehead.
Oh.
And so my mom had relatives and her mom and dad in San Gabriel, California. We came here, and then as life progressed, and as my wife will say, unfortunately, I met with her and we got married. So I wound up in all, I should backtrack a little bit. If any of you remember Angelo Dundee, who was a famous boxing trainer and everything else, after we arrived in California and I'd been working for a drugstore chain, with the impetuousness of youth, I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to go back to Florida. So we wound up in Florida, and fourth night we were there, when I realized nobody was going to come and give me a job or anything, I thought I better get off my butt. Well, my wife thought I better get off my butt and go find something. I happened to look in the paper and saw the Miami Beach Auditorium was having wrestling. So instead of looking for a job, I thought, well, I'll go down there and I won't tell Marilyn about it. So I did go down there, and it was dusty, and I can't remember who he fought, but Miami Beach Auditorium was extremely a hotbed at that time, as most of Florida was. Somehow, while I was there, I started talking to one of the guys that worked for Angelo Dundee, and he says, hey, you know, if you're hunting for a job, we need somebody to sell Cokes and refreshments and all of this. I says, I'm your man. I can do that. And remember, I'm 20-some years old, barely 20. So anyway, we we agreed on something, and basically what you did, you took your Coke, your beer, whatever it was, the wrestling, and whatever you sold it for, you got a certain commission on it. You didn't get a salary. Mm-hmm. So the first week they called me up and says, would you like to come down? I thought, hey, I get to sell refreshments and see wrestling. Life is good. There's no problem. I went down there, and it wasn't wrestling that night. It was the Miss Universe pageant. That's when they had it in Miami.
Well, you must have been in pain.
Even I knew, wait a minute, maybe this is better than watching Dusty, even though I hate to say that. But so I went, I got downstairs in the cavernous bottom of the place, and they gave me a tray, and they put beer on it. Okay. So go out and sell it, kid. Now, the guy that was telling me this was probably 15 sheets to the wind as he was saying it. He says, but take your button that says how much your beer is, turn it over, and then sell it for $2 instead of $1. I said, oh, I never thought of that. That's great. So I did. He says, if they catch it, what are they going to do? Okay. Yeah. So anyway, make a long story short, when I came out, they said, well, you have this section over here. I went over there, and there's all sorts of guys in uniforms and dress blues and everything. Annapolis was doing their yearly cruise to somewhere to let the guys get out of Annapolis for a while and live it up a little bit. So all these sailors, midshipmen, everything were in my section. They hadn't seen girls in a long time because at that time there were no girls around the academy. They hadn't been drinking in a long time. I almost became Howard Hughes that night. I couldn't sell enough beer and everything. I told my wife, life is a bowl of roses. We got it made. Anyway, came back here. Always, I had been doing wrestling stories like Tom and such. And I met up with Jesse Hernandez from EWF. And for the last 20 years, I've been working on EWF promotion, et cetera, et cetera. And someday I'm going to get a real life.
Well, Tom, how about you? What's how did you get involved with this business, and what drew you to it originally?
Well, I think like all of us baby boomers, sure, some of us were pre-baby boomers, Frank. You know, you were from the Doughboy era. But anyways, make a long story short, back in the 50s, wrestling was on every Saturday afternoon on a local TV station in Springfield, Mass, Channel 22, and the telecast was Studio Wrestling from Boston. It wasn't the old films that were Buffalo and Cleveland that we used to see, but it was a studio wrestling. It was called Bedlam from Boston, promoter Paul Bowser.
Bowser, yeah.
And you had these guys in there, and it was all action-packed, and the camera angles and the interviews with Sam Menneker were just phenomenal. Killer Kowalski, Pat O'Connor, Pepper Gomez, who you had mentioned earlier, yeah. Dan. You know, Kenji Shibuya, who was Mr. Hito with Mr. Moto. Mm-hmm. And all these guys were just phenomenal. I was in the sixth grade. All my compadres, I went to a Catholic school. Saturday afternoon, Sunday morning, we'd all be at Mass. And we'd be standing outside the church talking about what transpired. and this would continue on all week long till the next Saturday. So it became routine. And then the bomb dropped. Jan 22 dropped the bomb. Paul Bowser died. And that was 1958, but he died in 60. So we had 2 years of the wrestling. And then when he died, there were efforts by other promoters, Eddie Quinn for one, mm-hmm. who was his partner, came down from Montreal, who was originally a Massachusetts boy, and he was going to resurrect it. But Eddie Quinn was also involved in boxing. And at that time, the federal government was doing an investigation in boxing with the mafia. And for some reason, Eddie Quinn withdrew from boxing and wrestling. And he ended up going to New Hampshire and passing away. Why he passed away at an early age is beyond me. Anyways, make a long story short, then the office boy who worked for Paul Bowser by the name of Tony Santos took over wrestling in New England. And he had his partner, the great, wonderful Jack Pfeffer.
Oh, yes.
And all of a sudden, we had no TV,
But we had these great names, such as Slugger Kowalski, Gorilla Macaron.
Was that Jack, the one that had Hobo Brazil?
Hobo Brazil we had. We had Smasher, there was a Smasher Sloan for McMahon, and we had Smasher Nolan. And we had all these name likes and everything.
Wasn't there even a Bruno Sammartino with an N instead of an M?
Who was Pancho Valdez.
Yeah.
Now, but we also had great talent that came through during that Santo era. And two of them became World Heavyweight Champs of the NWA. Ronnie Garvin and a little known fact, Harley Race. When he came through in the early 60s as the Great Mortimer. Which was a knockoff of the great Mortier, who was working for Vince. Well, this was my diet of wrestling. All my friends, except two of them, deserted wrestling. They went on to other things. And I just continued on.
Now, and then the year, I ask you really quick?
Yes.
Is that, that's where Chris Cole, Rondo started.
Yeah, so.
I was wondering if you had met
1965,
there.
I'm at Mountain Park in Holy Mass, which is an amusement park. They would have wrestling every Wednesday night. So being the enthusiast that I am, I can't get there before 15 minutes before the matches. I have to get there way early, like 2 hours early. And so anyways, I'm eating a hamburger and having a Coke. Young guy comes up to me. It's about, maybe about 4 feet away at the concession stand. And he looks at me, tall guy, blondish hair. Figured to be about my age. 18 at the time. He says, "Are you Tom Burke?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Who the hell are you?" He said, "I'm myself, you know?" And he smiles. He says, "We used to write to each other." And I look at him, "Well, what's your name?" And he wouldn't tell me his name. He says, "I lived in Seattle, Washington area." And then it dawned on me who he was. And I was, and then he says, "No, my name is Maurice Chevrier," which was a knockoff off of the magnificent Maurice Dubois, who was wrestling for Vince. Anyways, we shook hands, and he gave me his address, and blah, blah, blah. So we started talking. Well, that friendship was reunited that June of 1965 and continued till almost until he passed away. And if he was alive today, he'd be 68 years old. Chris Cole was probably the... He was way, way ahead of his time. He was doing rock music entrances long before anyone else in the late 70s and everything. The guy was an awesome guy. He did face makeup, the whole things. Chris had a few demons in the closet and out of the closet. But Chris was an awesome guy. I miss him dearly. And I... I've been very blessed in that, but getting back to my involvement in wrestling, it was at that time period that the, and this was not only in Massachusetts, but all over the country, there was always a local promoter, or a local agent for the office. And in our case here, we had a gentleman by the name of Vito Tallarita, who was a boxing guy. And when I introduced myself, I had a fan club called All-Star Wrestling Fan Club. And I gave him my bulletin and blah, 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 and all that, and asked if I could interview one of some of the wrestlers. So he hooked me up with Ronnie Dupree. And I interviewed Ronnie and blah, 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 never realizing years later we'd become very good friends. But it was a unique experience getting there. But I just want to travel back in time before that to my first match.
Yeah.
My Everybody first remembers live your card. First match.
My first live card. Was December 29th, 1959. It was my Christmas gift from my dad. You know, I'm looking for some big box and everything. All these open it up and tickets to the wrestling show. I was nuts.
Oh,
so we went to the show because you know, I was like 13, couldn't drive yet. Some people still say I can't drive. That's beside the point. But anyways, we go to the show. Stormy night. The main event was going to be Chief Big Heart versus The Sheik. No show on Chief Big Heart. Red Bastien, former CAC president, took the spot. And there were two other cancellations. And one of the other cancellations took place and it ended up becoming Bull Curry took the place of the guy. Well, 8 guys on the card, I got to meet 6 of them. Out of those 6 guys, 4 of them became very good friends, to such a point that I was, 20 years later, I was driving Bull Curry to the matches. Mm-hmm. And now I'm driving his grandson to the match. it's just a wonderful thing, you know. I mean, I've had a close relationship with the Curry's family since the 70s, mm-hmm. and you know, I think what it is, I think Franco agrees with me, and you gentlemen as well. Mm-hmm. When you see these guys when you're a young kid, mm-hmm. and everything, and it evolves from not only a hero worship thing, but to a true friendship. Mm-hmm. Yes. And that is something that is unique. I had an incident a couple years ago. Kill Kowalski and I were very close. I used to work for Walter doing publicity and everything. And he had passed away. And I was asked to be one of the eulogists. So I did the eulogy. About 6 months later, I'm at a high school get-together. And a gentleman by name of, I won't mention his name on the air, but anyways, he came up to me. He was always a kind of a pain in the butt to me. And he says, "Hey, Burke, are you still doing the wrestling crap?" And I said, "You know what, Boots?" I said, "I am." I said, "I assume that you're still the big Ted Williams fan, right?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I just did a Killer Kowalski eulogy. Did you do one for Ted Williams?" As he turns around and walks away, Cassie LaFon comes up to me and says to me, "You know, Tom, once you're an a-hole, you're always an a-hole." Now, I assume she wasn't referring to me. Yeah. but that's how I developed in wrestling. Vito Telerita, the local wrestling promoter, was a big help to me, letting me interview the boys and everything. Mm-hmm. And then started writing for the magazines. And as Frank said, we used to have correspondent columns in Ring Box, Ring Magazine, mm-hmm. and in Ring Wrestling, and Wrestling As You Like It. Good. You know? And I started doing my work for Ring Magazine, Ring Wrestling Magazine. And as years developed, when I went in the military for 3 years, from 1966 to 69, I never came home. I was stationed in Germany, which was a blessing. And I traveled all over Europe attending wrestling events, you know? It was just great. And wow. I wrote for Lou Eskin for Wrestling Review and Nat Lube for Ring Magazine while I was there. And when I came home, I ended up getting a job in New York City for Trailways Bus Lines. So one day I had my days off, and I'm walking around the city. I said, "Gee, the Ring Magazine office is around here someplace." And I remember the address. I went in and introduced myself. We started talking, and he says, "Yeah, you want to do some more writing?" I said, "Yeah, I'll do something. I'll do a fan club column," he says. I said, "Fine, that's fine." And he says, "Are you off? Are you working?" I said, "Well, I got a regular job, but I used to work midnight to 8, and then I would be off." And he says, "Well, why don't you come in the office a couple hours a week and, you know, file pictures, answer mail?" I said, "Sure." So I did that for 7 years. And that was just phenomenal. Yeah. You know? I mean, it was really fun and everything. And then I got more and more involved in everything and met wonderful friends like Kurt and Dan, mm-hmm. and Frank and everything. And then the Cauliflower Alley comes along and everything. And, you know, so it's been a wonderful, wonderful time. It really has. It's a fabric of my life. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
And I think that having this involvement in wrestling has allowed me to meet so many different people of all varieties. You know, my grandmother on my father's side used to have this saying, it's not what you are, it's how you are as a person. And mm-hmm. and that's always been my philosophy. And as I've come in, and I think that has helped, having that philosophy, mm-hmm. because you certainly meet an array of different people you normally wouldn't meet, you know?
Right, exactly.
In wrestling, not only then, but even now.
Yeah.
You know, I'm involved in a local group back home, like Frank is. I think all of us are involved in somehow,
yes.
You know?
Every one of us here.
And I'm involved in one promotion that's is called Old Time, excuse me, New Age Old Time Wrestling. I love it. And we have a bunch of kids, and I shouldn't say kids, they're not kids, but they're younger people.
Once we're over 50, we get to call.
Yeah, that's right. Once we're over 50 is right. Everybody else is a kid. But they're a bunch of good people, got some good talent and everything. And we have integrated an old school philosophy. You know, like I've told the guys, the promoters, we don't want you to emulate what you see on TV. Make your own character. Mm-hmm. So we have an Indian, we have a Viking, we have a masked guy, called Mr. Nobody from Parts Unknown. I just little things, you know, and you know, it's a lot of fun. But you just take things and you work with it and you have fun, you know. And we draw 150 people, 200 people, you know. And the promoter, who is no young guy, he's 60. He went to school with my sister. He was a neighbor of ours, and he doesn't take BS from the guys, you know. And there was a situation with one particular wrestler that wasn't following orders and what he was supposed to do. He's always doing something he was told constantly not to do. And he went up to the, after his show, after his match, where in the dressing room, he says, "What's my next booking?" And the pro says, "This was your last one." And the guy, what? He says, I don't need you.
Yeah. You know, that's it. Can we get a use, Tom, from Todd's own?
Yeah, how much do you charge? We'll fly you out of California for some of our indie shows.
That's how it is, you know, and it's just been a lot of fun. And I'm looking for years to come.
Oh, and I want to jump in and say, you know, Tom was talking about the people who got his foot in the door in the wrestling business, and Tom is the very first connection I had to the wrestling business. I probably wouldn't be here with all you guys if it weren't for him, because I was a big fan of ring wrestling. I enjoyed the aftermags too, but when I saw ring wrestling, I saw that it was half kayfabe, but a read between the lines for fans who were smart,
exactly,
too.
Yeah.
And I did not know. Tom was actually like the phantom editor of the magazine at the time. And I would read these historical articles, and then I started taking Tom's newsletter, a global wrestling news service. Mm-hmm. And I remember it said, "Our office hours are like Wednesday, Thursday. And you can call to orders." And I'm like, wow, the Global Wrestling Library. I think I pictured the Library of Congress or something. But I was like 16, and I'm calling him. I'm shaking, nervous. I'm going to talk to Tom Burke. He's probably just going to say, "Get out of here, kid." But he ended up talking to me about everything under the sun. We hit it off right away. And after knowing him for just about a year, he just says, "So, Kurt, who are some of the boys working in the territory?" And I'm rattling off some names, and one of the names I rattled off was Barry Orton, and he says, "Okay, Kurt, I'm writing Jeff Walton. I'm going to tell him you're going to be at the San Bernardino Arena, and I will send you a press card." And almost like your first match, you remember the first time you have some connection, and so I remember bringing the press card, and Barry Orton actually knew, "Oh, Tom Burke, I know that guy." And I'm like, "Wow, I'm part of the business now." And that led me to be getting involved, to eventually getting in the ring and just, being an eternal child, and I have Tom to thank for that.
So now you know who to send the emails to blame.
That's right,
Well, California wrestling, Los Angeles. Did you guys ever get to watch San Francisco wrestling up close, or was it mostly Southern California?
Southern California.
What sticks out in your mind? How would you categorize Southern California wrestling, as opposed to every territory had its own flavor, its own feel to it. How would you categorize Los Angeles wrestling?
I have to look at the Southern California wrestling with two eyes. When I first saw it, when I used to go to Vermont in the summertime at my grandparents' farm, they used to get wrestling from Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And this would have been in the 60s. And those were older films before the 60s. But I saw like Gorgeous George, Vic Christie, all these guys. And that it was pristine wrestling. As years progressed into the 70s, when I was living in New York, one of the UHF stations in New Jersey carried Los Angeles wrestling, and we saw Blasi and Natolis and all these guys. and everything, Gordman, Goliath, and all those characters and everything. So I got to see that, you know, and it had an influence on wrestling on the East Coast. And I've always thought about this. When Blasi and Tolles were on top in L.A., all of a sudden, out of nowhere, John Tolles was on an MSG show in a singles match. Mm-hmm. So the appeal was there, and Vince Sr. knew it and was bringing him in, you know. And then, of course, Blasi had already worked in the area, you know, so he was well established. They were bringing Tolles in by popular demand, maybe, or to give it a try or see what happens. But I've always kind of thought that was neat. So I did see the LA wrestling from thousands of miles away on TV, but then on a personal note, I had interaction when I traveled all over, and I went to San Francisco, and I also went to the LA area. First time was in 72 to attend a WFIA convention, which was Wrestling Fans International Association convention in LA. It's actually in Santa Monica. And then I returned a year later and just to tour around and hang out with the guys and everything. So that was a lot of fun.
Well, and it always fascinates me because you consider the San Francisco and the Los Angeles office existing in the same state and couldn't it be any more different than they actually were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean from philosophy, from how they did everything.
Yeah,
and the fact that that Shire and LaBelle hated each other so much and will go out of their way to give each other a hard time.
From what I understand, they had one thing in common: they were both misers.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's unfortunately is a lot of promoters.
There's a lot there. But Mike LaBelle, I didn't realize this until he passed away, that I didn't realize he never watched the matches. He was just in his office guarding his money.
Yeah.
And if something didn't draw, he just...
That's all he was interested in.
Okay, the booker, go away. We need a new booker. The audience didn't go up in like 3 weeks.
Mike's interest in the matches ended when the first match started, because at that point, all he cared about was about the box office.
It's amazing it had the boom it did.
It did.
Yeah.
Frank, what was the first show you went to at the Olympic? Or, did you guys tell us?
Well, just a little bit kick on the roof. Both Tom and Kurt were mentioning, first of all, San Bernardino, because that became sort of my second home. We lived 60 miles away, and every Sunday, I believe it was, as a fan, we would go down there. Well, I got involved at that point. Now, the San Bernardino Arena, for the people that aren't out here, the San Bernardino Arena was a squat little building that probably should have been condemned 100 years ago, but it was the best venue in this area.
And I loved that arena.
Absolutely. I love that place. In the summertime, because they had no air conditioning, they wanted to keep the temperature to an even 130, 140. You'd come in there and you'd watch the guys work, and they'd put a headlock and the guy would just fall out of it because it was sweating so hard that it would just come right out. And that, of course, was where guys like Goliath and Black Gordman just would tear the place apart when they came in, as Kurt may know from the time you were there.
Oh, my God, yeah.
When they came into the ring, the fans in San Bernardino, they were ready to just explode.
I tell people there's not very many Gordman Goliath matches on tape, but if you want to see classic heel artistry, those two, I'll go as far as say two of the top five heels I've ever seen.
Oh, easily.
Absolutely. There was one match there where they did a run out of the ring, and now that was a squat little arena.
There was no room.
There was no room. When you were in the ring, the front row was like
it was built for
two
boxing.
2 feet away from you.
You could touch the mat from your chair. Yeah.
Yes.
I remember that.
I have to tell you, I had a boss one time who was a very nice gentleman, but was like he was from the military. Every clothes he wore, every Levi's he wore, were Levi's were pressed and everything. And after the years, I finally got him to come down to the San Bernardino Arena. Don't ask me how I did it, because he was just spit and polish guy. And I finally begged on him, ragged on him, and why don't you come on down to the arena one time, Bill? You'll have a great time. August. So we go in the arena, and I can't remember who it was, but I almost swear it was Blasi in the main event. Anyway, we're front row because I'm going to get him front row. There's no other way. Well, he's, like I said, very smart businessman, everything else. But his eyes are wide because he's never seen anything like wrestling fans. And he's looking around, and the beers are flowing, and the sweat's flowing from the guys. And all of a sudden, Blassie throws somebody out. He lands about 2 feet from Bill, and three fans behind me take their beers and throw them on Blassie. Half of it gets on my boss. Now, I still stayed employed, but I wasn't sure for how long. But he never went back. I don't know why. I was there the night Blassie's Cadillac got burned up.
Oh, no way.
And yes, I was there. It was parked, and all of a sudden, we were just coming out for some reason, just taking a break, and you heard some people yelling and everything, so I ran. It was a rinky-dink little parking lot, as you may know.
That's being generous.
And there
yeah, that is. We usually park down the street so our car would be
yeah,
safe.
Yeah, that's right, which wasn't exactly safe, but we didn't tell
safer.
People that. Safer. But the flames, you saw the red glow out and back and everything, and then Blassie comes running out and sees it, and he used words as a Marine Corvette I never even heard about. But he was just bent. And then, of course, you know, 6 months later, Blassie talking about in the interview and laughed like mad when he talked about it.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That night, if the fans had been around, there would have been homicide victims at that time. He was not a happy camper. Let me go back. L.A. was wonderful. You know, we ran San Bernardino, Oxnard, Ventura. There was a whole big circuit. One night, I was in San Diego, and I was basically a nicely taken care of gopher for a long time. But anyway, for some reason, was in the old Coliseum in San Diego on F Street,
yeah,
which was a step up from San Bernardino, but not much. But I walked back in there, and the guys were all sitting around talking and doing various things and everything. And there's this one guy sitting in the back in a chair with his back to everybody else and just reading a book. I'm a book reader. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. Well, it turned out that it was Jesse Ventura before he came so
oh
big.
My gosh.
And he had a book on politics and he was sharing it. So I thought that was rather interesting. I have to tell you, if I got time for two quick stories,
I promise not to
yell as loud as I usually do. One of them involves my wife. My wife had never seen a wrestling match before we got married. And then, of course, she says my life went to hell. But anyway, we were down. After a year of being married, I told her we ought to take a honeymoon. It would be nice to do it. She says, yes, it would be. And she was a California girl, never been out of California. So I said, I'll take you to Acapulco. Wonderful, honey. Oh, that's so nice. Where are you going to get the money? I said, don't worry. We'll cover that. So we did. We went to Acapulco. She'd never been on an airplane. She was wide-eyed at that. Wow. We get into Acapulco. First day we go down the beach, blah, blah, blah. And the next day I tell her, Marilyn, look, the ad in the paper, it says Lucha Libre. What the heck is that? I says, that's wrestling with a Spanish accent. And so she says, I suppose you're going to want to go. I said, yeah, but I want you to come with me because I want you to experience Mexico. So after some time, well, this is in the early or late 50s when the women's hairdo were these beehive hairdos that, mm-hmm. you know, stuck 15 feet up in the air and they were put together with super glue or something. So she says, okay, how far away is it? I says, it's about a half a mile and we'll walk there. She, okay. So we're going at 6 o'clock in the evening and I see Mil Mascaras was on the card and I can't remember who else. And I says, great. If you've ever been to Acapulco at nighttime, Acapulco has a lot of bats in it. Okay? So we're walking down, we come under a street light. All of a sudden, Marilyn screams like mad. A bat had flown down and got trapped in her head. Now, she's, you know, this little naive California girl had not had a lot of experience. She's grabbing like that, and some other women are coming up trying to help her. She's yelling, the bat screaming because he's scared to death. He's like super glue. Or anyway, eventually get that, and I was not killed going to the arena then. But anyway, we get to the arena, and I said, well, I've got to show her what a good wrestling match is in Mexico. So, of course, I think at that time for 50 cents you could get front row ringside. Mm-hmm. So I told her, well, I had like 10,000 people in there, and about, I would say, five of them, including us, were, I'll put it nicely, pale complected. Okay, everybody else was in there enjoying, and they had the wire covering the ring because of the mariachis and whatever else you threw into the ring when the bad guys were there. So she's sitting down ringside. I'm sitting down with her, and I says, I'm going to go get us some Cokes or something. I do. I leave, and these two or three guys that were sitting around us, very nice, I thought, and everything. As soon as I left, they're all trying to put the make on her in Spanish. She doesn't understand Spanish. These guys are beating the living daylights out of one another. Things are flying into the, hitting the chicken wire, falling down on the ground. She comes, she says, if you ever take me to a place like that again.
I had no idea you were such a romantic, friend.
Oh, yes. I know. It's one of my failings. One other quick story on Empire Wrestling Federation in San Bernardino, which is who I work with. And I'm very happy to be working with him. But yes, Jesse has been known to be careful with his pennies, I should say that nicely, in case he's listening. Yes, Carl, I said that. Anyway, one time we're doing a show in a suburb of LA that I won't mention the name of because I don't want to get sued, but it was sponsored by a local school. Well, one of the guys that was on the card that night, it was like his fifth match or something. He was going to be a good heel. So anyway, we get there, we do the thing, and this guy gets all dressed and everything. The part of it that was a little bit unusual, he got dressed in trunks, but forgot to put on any protective covering underneath the trunks, oh, and no. These trunks were wide, okay?
Showtime.
So, yeah, it was showtime, all right, in more ways than I like to remember. But anyway, in about the third fall, we don't do that anymore, but in about the third minute, somebody takes him and slings him across the ring. Now, I've got three members of the Board of Education for that sitting there, two women and a man. And they're sitting there front row so they can see what a great job we do. And this guy slides, and he comes under the ring, and the left foot goes here, and the right foot goes here, and the shorts blossom out like that. Now, I'm looking, and I'm thinking, okay, that's the last time for this school district. I can tell that.
And did they say, nuts to you?
But the life and times of independent promotion, as Tom can attest to, and you know, and Dan knows, can be interesting. They have some amazing events.
Anyone who has ever promoted an indie wrestling show at one point has said, well, that's the end of this building.
Yes.
For one reason or another, something just happened, and we're never coming back here ever again, you know? Any memorable? Tom, you started to tell me a story about Jeff Walton that I loved last night. Would you mind about visiting his office? Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I got two stories about Jeff Walton.
Okay, good. Let's hear them.
And everything.
Because we love Jeff.
Yeah. Jeff's a very good friend of mine, and I've known Jeff since we used to be pen pals back in the 60s. When the WFIA started in 1960. They had their first convention and their formation of an organization. They had an election for president, and the two runners up was Jeff Walton and myself. I beat Jeff. Well, Jeff went on to become a world famous wrestling associate.
Thank God there wasn't a trophy involved, because you know what happens with trophies.
And Jeff became involved in the LA office and a promoter, and also worked for WWE as a writer when the magazine first came out. But Jeff was a longtime friend. And when we had the WFIA convention in LA, actually it was in Santa Monica, but the LA office ran it, of course. It was in 1972, and we had a very, very informal luncheon one day with a number of the local, one of the wrestlers that attended and everything. And I had commented to Jeff after about it and everything. I said, hey, too bad other wrestling offices don't take the lead. And Jeff said, Tom, we are Hollywood orientated. We know the value of the fans,
right,
and everything. And that you know, and I always thought about that after, you know. But Jeff's a great guy. That was in 72. 1973, I came back to California. Don Wilson, who was the founder of the WFIA, was now living in the LA area and working for the wrestling office, and I came in and stayed with him, and I went to visit the LA office. and they were very cordial. Larry Korn, Art Williams. There was,
who was here, actually?
Art Williams. Yeah, I reminisced with Art a little while ago. And there was another individual I can't... Bob Kubik.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bob Kubik. And we... Anyways, we'll get on that everything later on.
Maybe Kurt may have to leave the room for a while. <That's okay.
laughs> Anyways, make a long story short. When we got to the office and they were introducing me. Of course, I didn't know Larry Korn, I didn't know Larry Art Williams, but I didn't know Kubik from the WFIA days. And we started talking, and I could not help but see a map of the United States behind Jeff Walter's chair. It was mounted on the wall, and there were map pins all across the United States with little names on the map pins. And I said, Jeff, this is right. I got to go up and take a look at that. And I went up, and it was the names of wrestling promoters that promoted in that area. Like the central stage would be a Bob Brown and Bob Geigel, right. You know, or McMahon would be East Coast. But that it was just phenomenal. It's something that I always wondered what happened to those pins and that map. I'd love that to be a great collectible.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, that was my time period in the office, and I went several times, and they were very cordial. And Don Wilson was running the town of El Monte, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think that was his town. And he asked me if I'd be interested in ring announcing. Well, I said, geez, yeah, that'd be great. So I did the ring announcing and everything. And then, dawned on me later, I was unlicensed, So I was an outlaw ring announcer.
But, and back then you had to have a license to be a ring announcer.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
Yeah, I don't know how it was done.
Yeah.
I don't know if they... if the local commissioner was a friend of the promotion or what. That's what I'm assuming took place, So, I did it one time. That was fun. But I stayed for a little over a week, and I remember driving with Larry Korn and I think it was Art Williams. We went from El Centro night.
Well,
that was just the lower California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Till the furthest northern point in the circuit was Santa Rosa.
Oh. I didn't know they ran all the way up there.
That was one night. We wow. did the show, and then off we ran for the next show. That was a long, long drive,
Yeah.
And of course, coming from the east, when you drive in the east and you go, within an hour, you see towns and cities.
Yeah.
Here we see nothing, mm-hmm. It was just totally amazing. But it was an experience. It was a great experience. And, Don was trying to convince me to, move out west and, quit my job and everything. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he left the L.A. office and started Phoenix, or reopened Phoenix. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I kind of like Phoenix. I had been through there. And Greyhound Bus Lines, that's where their headquarters was at the time. And I was working for Trailways Bus Lines. I see it'd be kind of easy to get a job and everything, but I said to myself, no, I'm going to stay where I am. I'm lucky I did, because that eventually folded.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, it was a fun time, a growing experience, And, of course, my ring announcing continued on as years progressed for various local promotions back home. Actually, I did the NWA promotion in Springfield when the
really?
NWA came. Yeah, Gary Juster asked me if I could replace Gary Michael Capetta, who was their ring announcer, because he couldn't do the Springfield show. He did Boston Garden. He couldn't do the Springfield show the next night. He asked me if I'd do it. So I said, yeah. So that was it. And I got a nice payoff.
Well, I'm going to ask you, since you were so close to Killer Kowalski, and I met Kowalski on a couple occasions, most, and again, through Cauliflower Alley, which is where you got a chance to do that prior to this. I found him to be such an interesting guy. He's full of gusto. And he talked about how when he was at the Olympic Auditorium, because he had a very big angle out here that involved, he was teaming with Kenji Shibuya and wrestling Tolos and whatever, going downstairs and training a young Big John Studd at that point, breaking him into the business. John Minton at that time.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about some stuff about Killer Kowalski that maybe the average fan wouldn't know. That you can tell us, Lee.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw that hesitation Kowalski, for a second. Yeah.
Well, I was just gathering my thoughts.
Okay.
Kowalski was different from not only the average wrestler, but I think the average man. He lived a very private monastic life. He would get up in the morning at 5 o'clock and meditate for 2 straight hours. He was very monastic. He was Catholic with a slight bent on the Eastern side with mysticism, which is nothing new to Catholicism anyway. But I think Walter was a little off-key having talked to him and everything. But anyways, because I stayed with Walter on a number of occasions at his home. And, you know, some... What the hell's that smell? He's burning incense and chanting.
Awesome.
You know, but, you know, but that's how Walter was. And he was a vegetarian.
Yes.
Complete vegetarian. And he was an individual who had some, shall we say, ultra-conservative viewpoints politically. Even though he was open to everybody, but he was fiercely conservative, very much so, and everything. But he made sure he ran all the shows when Welfare Day would be coming around. So, you know, so make sure, you know, that somebody's coffers would be filled.
Yes.
But Walter was good. And Walter was an excellent photographer. He published his own book. He had art shows featuring photography in the greater Boston area, as well as one show in New York that I'm aware of. And let me get back just on his name, Kowalski. If you ever saw the movie Gran Torino with Clint Eastwood.
Yes. Yeah.
There's some symbolism there. Clint Eastwood played Kowalski. His name was Mr. Kowalski.
Mm-hmm.
He worked in a manufacturing company which made motor vehicles. Kowalski, Walter Kowalski, Gil Kowalski, when he was trained to be a wrestler, worked in Detroit at the Ford Motor Company. And it all ties in. And I've always thought that the producers or the writers of that show took that image of Kowalski and made it for Clint Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I may be far off, but I don't think so. But anyways, let me get back to the name Kowalski, where it came, how it originated, because it's a fantastic story. And this is getting away from L.A., getting away from Boston,
okay,
settling in Detroit. Yeah. Kowalski got his start in wrestling through Burt Ruby, who is a local wrestling promoter in Detroit. And he was training on his time period, and his real name was, his last name was Sputnik, like Sputnik Monroe.
Monroe.
Yeah.
You know, that was his last name. Burt Ruby did not like the name. They had to give him a new name. Across from the gym was a Kowalski Pole Sauces factory. And that's how the name developed. So it became Walter Kowalski. So, and because his first name was Edward. And Eddie Sputnik would... Killer Edward Sputnik doesn't...
No, it doesn't. That's not going to bring me to him.
Yeah. But that's how his name started. Mm-hmm. And everything.
Were you around when a young Paul Levesque started attending Kowalski's school?
Triple
H. What do you remember about that?
Terror Rising was his first ring. I met Paul when he first started, young kid, very polite. We talked. Walter introduced me to him, you know, and I have probably some pictures of him when he was first started,
mm-hmm,
and everything. And he contrary to what a lot of people think about him, I think he's a good guy. I like him. I respect him. He has a passion for the history of wrestling, unlike his father-in-law. he and I have communicated together since he's been in that position. The concept of Vince is to have a Wrestling Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Ben Brown, who is here at the audit, who is here at CAC, is the archivist for the WWE,
oh.
who's been to my home on a number of occasions, who was told to contact me through William Regal, who I'm friends with,
yeah.
and Triple H, mm-hmm. and he's been up several times. And we have negotiated a transfer of memorabilia from my collection to their upcoming museum.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And because I'm close to 68, and, you stop and think, well, if you want to share it with the world,
yeah,
this is the way
true.
To do it.
That's
you
true.
Know?
Yes.
And Levesque, Triple H, I have a lot of respect for him. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I saw him was at the Killer Kowalski's funeral because
mm-hmm.
he was one of the pallbearers.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah.
How did you get to come to meet Dr. Jerry Graham? Because I met him indirectly through you.
I got to stop and think how I'm a doc.
In oh. radio land, that's called a pregnant pause.
And we're going to do a C-section right now.
This goes back to the WFIA. And I'm bad. They tell me I'm a historian, but I'm horrible at years. For years. The WFIA was running in Atlanta in association with the Paul Jones, the NWA office.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Ann Gunko was running a rival promotion.
Right.
Yeah.
Dr. Jerry was working for the Gunko promotion.
Mm-hmm.
That is when I met Dr. Jerry the second time. I had met him previously, and for some reason, I can't remember the first time I met Doc, but I remember Doc Graham. We're in his hotel room. A bunch of us, and he had ordered a case of beer. Well, he's walking from the bedroom into the facilities because he has to relieve himself. But as he did, he was walking by, he picked up a bottle of beer, and you could hear him guzzling and draining at the same time. And it's something I'll never forget. Well, anyways, I just thought of when I first met Dr. Jerry outside of wrestling. I was working in New York City at the Port Authority bus terminal. And I was a dispatcher.
I know the story.
So I'm walking by, and I see this big guy in a seat there with blonde hair. Jeez, he's got to be a wrestler. I walked around, and actually I recognized Doc, and I went up and introduced myself and everything. And then he tells me he's going to Atlanta. That's what it was. And then, we blah, blah, blah. One thing led to another. We were friends ever since. But for all you people out there that know Dr. Jerry Graham and these crazy stories, my father passes away. I get a phone call. Hey, Tom, I heard your dad died. I'm coming up for the funeral. And I said, oh, my God. But Doc was good. And then I had the opportunity to meet Doc a few years before he passed through Kirk.
Yes, yes. Everything. We have that great interview you did with him at Cauliflower Alley.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that meeting at the bus station? He always told us a story like, I was sitting at the bus station. I spent all my money cat dancing, and I have no place to go. How am I going to make the next town? And who walks up but Tom Burke? And you said that you got him on the bus.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The man needs a movie made about his life.
Totally.
He really
yes,
does.
Yes,
the good doctor is there was never anyone like him, and there'll never be anyone else.
Absolutely.
And some people would say thank God, but I don't think that's true. We're starting to wrap up here. I do have a question. This is for me. This is for the little wrestling fan in me. I love John Tolis. John Tolles is my favorite wrestler of all time. I watched him out here, and I got a chance to meet him through Cauliflower Alley, and he was actually kind of a neighbor. I've told that story a million times. He lived out in Woodland Hills, and I would see him from time to time, and my wife would roll the window down and yell, "Golden Greek!" And he would go, "Right here, baby!" Like that, or right into it. And he was the funniest guy in the world. Do you guys have any stories or any memories of John Tolles at all?
I've just got a real quick one. At one of the last Cauliflower Alley get-togethers here in Vegas, I was coming by one of the rooms there, an exercise room, and I walked by, and John was in there, and I can't remember who else was there, but John was by himself, but he was working on weights or something, and he looked up at me. Now, I really had met him probably 5 years ago, very briefly. I'm sure he didn't know who the hell I was. But anyway, I just waved, says, "Hi, how you doing?" He says, "Oh, I'm doing fine. Can you come here a minute?" "Okay, sure. You know, John Tolles asked you to come.
Yeah,
you go." Okay, so I did. And he just got on a riff about wrestling now and keeping in shape. And, of course, he was looking at me when he was talking about getting in shape. And I'm, you know, okay. But we must have had a 20-minute conversation with him sitting on some kind of bench thing. I don't discuss the bench and weights and everything because I figure that's a sin against God to get exercise. But anyway, he was really, really nice. And for a change, instead of me thinking, how am I going to get to this guy, it was like he wanted to talk to me. And I was really pleased and flattered because, I'd seen him in action in San Bernardino when there were people there that would have burned him in effigy if they could have gotten to him, because again, he was an ultimate consummate master of villainy.
He could make
people just do things. You said something about wrapping up. Mm-hmm. Let me do one quick story.
Sure.
That changed my attitude forever on wrestling.
Okay.
Because I had all my buddies at school would always tell me, "Bunch of phony baloney, those guys couldn't tie their own shoelace, da-da-da, they never get hurt." And in Virginia, Norfolk, and Richmond, which was Bill Lewis's territory, he drew tremendous crowds in those days. And he also had tremendous riots. They were always having problems. But anyway, so I'm down there and I'm doing, I don't know if I was doing sweeping up or whatever it was as a young gopher you're doing, but I'm doing it for him. And some of you gentlemen, and I know Tom brings up the fact he's 60-some years old, so he's just a damn young juvenile delinquent as far as I'm concerned, and all the rest of you guys. Do you guys remember a wrestler by the name of Hans Schnabel?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And, of course, the Becker brothers, George and Bobby.
Yeah, they wrestled out here.
Yes, right, they did. Well, they would always take tours of the Mid-Atlantic area. The Beckers facing the Dusicks, as I'm sure they did out here. But George was a particular hero to the Navy guys there. And so whenever he was in town, it was just, the place was just jam-packed. Well, they had a blow-off match with him and Hans Schnabel. During the match, they're doing their thing and everything, and at one point, Becker's down on the ground, and Schnabel is beating the living daylights out of him, and people are yelling and screaming because they hate Schnabel, and Becker was the number one guy. And Becker comes up, and I don't know if it was hard way, I think it was. He's got blood pouring from his forehead and all this stuff, and he's just starting to jump up. Schnabel is above him. And from high up in the bleachers at the old auditorium, somebody took an industrial staple that you would use in woodworking and shot it at Schnabel. And it hit Becker, and it hit him right above the eye. And you could see it sticking out. And now the place went just crazy. The cops and the shore patrol was in, pulling both Becker and Schnabel out of the ring and everything. And I thought at that time, these guys are tough. Yeah. And that's always been my attitude with people. I don't care what you say about it. These are the best and the toughest guys you will ever find, bar none.
Exactly. Well, Mr. Knapsack, have you been taking notes?
I've been taking great notes.
Because we've whiplashed each other with a lot of history here in the last hour. So do you have any questions you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I just want to say thanks for coming by to the Wrestling Viewpoint Network Studios, number one. But I what I love about professional wrestling is being one of the young kids you talked about. I got gray in my beard now. Is the rich history of wrestling that goes back and how
it's just tied to the current generation. The wrestling has changed. To hear the stories about Triple H for the younger fans out there, and just to hear, I love the territory talk. I wish we were still in territory times, back in the cloud, because it just, the stories go on and on and on. So I love, and I love to learn the connections from Doc Graham to Tom Burke. To this man, Caveman Wellington. That's great stuff. And then Kurt still being in the ring teaching the new kids now. In MPW, it was like, throw them with Kurt. That'll learn them.
Yeah. And I had a blast.
And that's what I love. So I love these stories.
I think we're done, aren't we? I didn't know if you wanted to say goodbye officially, or you're going to do it another way.
You can say goodbye, then I'll step into close.
Guys, thank you. This has been fabulous. And I was looking for something light to do this, and I'm glad that we were able to get together all here in Las Vegas and do it. And maybe we can do it again one day.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It was a fun time.
Fun time, yes, absolutely.
Thank you so much, gentlemen. So good to be here. And out there, if you have a chance to get into the Cauliflower Alley Club and come out to one of the reunions, you guys out there should do it. Next year's the 50th. Looking forward to that. So for Dan Farron, Kurt Brown, Frank Ma, Tom Burke, thank you so much for listening to California Classic Wrestling Podcast. Don't forget to find us on iTunes or Stitcher. If you're on iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review. That helps us out. We're on Twitter @WrestlingVN. So until next time, we will see you in the ring.